We talked about suffering, repairing the effects of transgression. We talked about it for the individual, but it works more broadly than that. Suffering can protect a community. The suffering of an individual could protect the community from a calamity. If that individual is very great, so that he doesn't deserve, personally, all the suffering that he's getting, the benefit of that suffering can spill over to others, to his community, to his generation, or even to the world as a whole, because of the results of Adam's failure, which created blemishes in the whole of the creation. Now, I said yesterday was this. This is one of the things that he says. If you imagine a person who is so great that when he suffers, there's a surplus. Not all of his suffering is necessary for his personal account. Some of it will be. For all normal people, there's some mistakes that they've made, or some reason that the suffering is directed to them personally, because of their individual lives. But also, there's a surplus. That surplus can be applied to the community, to the generation, to the world, and that is a very great merit. That the person should take upon himself the suffering which will help purify or protect others from a calamity and purify the world. It's a very great merit. Now, says Ramchal, this is inherently progressive. Let's say the person has 40 units of suffering. That's what he's feeling, what he's undergoing. Now let's say that he's such a great person that only 20 are relevant to his personal life. So 20 are surplus. And he accepts the other 20, the surplus, accepts them and dedicates them to protecting his generation or to purifying the world. That's a very great thing to do. Let's just finish the fire. That makes him even greater. Greater tzaddik. If he's an even greater tzaddik, then less of the 40 units that he's suffering are needed for his personal account. Let's say only 15 are needed now. So then 25 are surplus, which can be dedicated to the generation of the world. Now, if he accepts all 25 for that purpose of helping others, so then he's in even a bigger tzaddik. Anything bigger tzaddik, then the amount of the 40 that's relevant to his personal account goes down again. Now it's down to 10. Now the surplus is 30. And he's taking on even 30, which means he's even a bigger tzaddik. So you see that the effect of his suffering can become greater and greater. Now, of course, the limit is when all 40 are surplus. Right? Then there's nothing more he can do. But there is a certain progression here where his efforts can become more and more powerful. That's the point that I made that up. You have a question?
Yes, sir. What is acceptance and what is dedication?
I would say dedication is part of the acceptance. Acceptance means not to rebel, and then you accept them for a certain purpose. And
does it sound like direct that, or is it a reflection?
Well, I don't think he can direct it, but if he needs to accept it for that purpose. For example, let's think about the suffering directed just at the person himself. And it should help to cleanse him. Now, a person who will rebel against the suffering and say, it's not fair, I don't deserve it, and so on, it may very well not have any cleansing effect at all. If he accepts it for that purpose and says, listen, I know that I have failures, I know that they need to be repaired, so I accept this as God's loving repair of my failures, then it will definitely help. So the acceptance carries within it this kind of dedication. A person who will say, listen, I know I need to be rehabilitated, but I'm not willing to take anything on for anybody else. You know, leave me alone. Give them their own. I don't want to handle anybody else's problems. So then it might not have that effect. Indeed, he might not suffer, but then he loses the opportunity for that tremendous merit. Yeah.
Can it ever happen? Because, I mean, how is one ever going to know how much he deserved or what he's getting is
good? So he can accept it and dedicate it hypothetically. If there is anything here that's for me, I accept it. If there's anything there for others, I'm happy to do it. Okay? You can do it hypothetically. Yeah? Other hands up? Yeah, I'm surprised that nobody is yelling and screaming about Christianity here. What? One person suffering can help somebody else? Wasn't that the whole Christian idea? That he will suffer and thereby free other people of the effects of their sin and so on and so on? What do you mean? We would have a Christian idea? Now, I'm making fun of this because it deserves to be made fun of. Listen, Torah is not anti-Christianity. That's not how Torah is defined. Torah is not anti-anything. Torah is Torah. And where it disagrees with other positions, it disagrees. And where it agrees, it agrees. No one can chase us and say, well, look, since the Christians believe that, so you've got to oppose it. Not at all. If they happen to get something right, by accident, well, then they got it right. Well, we can't oppose them just because they happen to get something right. Now, as he said, what they typically do is they take an idea which has a source in the truth, and they distort it, they expand it, they transform it, they apply it in places where it doesn't belong. So you can sort of see where it came from, but by the time they get finished with it, it's hopeless. For example, we are born into a world, a degraded world, and every one of us suffers the fact that we are behind the eight ball, right? We're not created with 50-50 balance between our good and evil inclination. We're thrust into the physical world. The whole world is more physical and darker than it was for Adam. And we ask the question, why do we deserve that? Now, in some strains of Christianity, the answer is it's original sin. And you're born in sin. You're born in sin. And that's why you can't get out of it. Therefore, somebody else has to die for you to get you out of it. Now, from our point of view, that whole scenario makes no sense. You can't be born in sin. Sin is transgression, and transgression is an action you're responsible for. So you can't be born with a sin liability. That's a contradiction in terms. What was our answer? Our answer was that we're all parts of Adam, and we were all there present and participated in the sin. So we are living out the consequences of our own participation. We're not getting it because we're born into it. So you see that the world is degraded, and we are in a degraded personal state, physical state, and that state is a result of sin. That much is true. But then to take the giant leap and say, therefore you're born in sin and you're sinful just because you're born of woman and so on, that's a step into gobbledygook. You can't be born in sin. It's a contradictory concept. Sin only applies when you made a responsible decision to do something. And the answer is that we all did participate in that original responsible decision. And that squares it with morality straight.
And then the Christians don't believe that we're all part of Adam. We're all...
Let's put it this way. In the writings that I have read, this never comes up. You know, there's certainly no cite to measures. You know? Yeah.
Isn't one of the responses for suffering of the children in the Holocaust that they're atoning to the souls of the others, that other people?
No. No. One of them is reincarnation. That they are the very same souls that had bad careers before. But not that they're atoning for somebody else's souls. No. Not at all. Not at all. So, now, someone, I think, said yesterday, or if not, it should be said, we should try to explain this idea that A, suffering can help protect B, or help cleanse B. So I mentioned at the very end, and he says this explicitly, when we're talking about protection, we're talking about protection in this world only. So, the community has deteriorated to the point where a disaster is decreed on the community, the suffering of an individual, a very great individual, can protect the community from the disaster here. That has nothing to do with the world to come. In the world to come, each individual is addressed according to his own actions. Period. Nothing someone does here can take off someone's responsibility for his actions in the world to come. There's no such thing. Okay. Still, how could this person suffering spare the rest of the community a disaster which they have earned by their own terrible actions? Now, I can tell you what the rules are. Whether this is a full explanation or not, I'm not sure. But these are how the rules work. First of all, the Jewish people, in many respects, is treated as a whole, an integrated whole. A hint of this comes from certain psukim and certain statements in the Talmud. The Sanhedrin are called Einei Ha'eda, the eyes of the congregation. The king is called Lev Ha'am, the heart of the nation. Okay, I know, you think it's poetry. Well, it's a poetical expression of a metaphysical fact. That the community form a kind of super individual, and particular people play roles in the composition of that super individual. The Sanhedrin plays the role of eyes, and the king plays the role of heart. Other people play the role of arms and legs, muscles, and blood vessels, and so on and so on. It's a cooperative, collective unit. I said in many respects, I didn't say total. That's important just as a qualification. But in many respects, it's like that. Now, that means that the suffering of one can count for the whole. You know, in the Inquisition, one of the torture machines they used was thumb screws. I said, oh gosh, how bad can that be? You know, it's only your thumb. Think how much of the body is not being touched. I'm afraid that doesn't matter. The pain is excruciating, and the pain is not felt by the thumb. The pain is felt by the person in his thumb. And the whole person is in excruciating pain because of his thumb. It doesn't affect only the thumb. So the community as a whole can be hit by directing the fire at certain individuals. Now, the Talmud says, in a certain respect, only next to Kameis, Sumas next to Kameis, a blind person is counted as if he wasn't fully alive. Let's take the two ideas together. A blind person is counted as if he isn't fully alive. And Sanhedrin is the eyes of the community. So if the Sanhedrin is hit, it's as if the whole community becomes blind. If the whole community becomes blind, it's as if the whole community was executed. That's a way of placating the attribute of justice. To say, listen, you demand the death of the community because of their failures. Well, here, the community is, so to speak, going blind, and blind is, in a certain sense, considered as if dead. That'll be enough for you. We're not giving you any more than that. But it's in the ballpark. The descriptions apply in a certain sense. So, it's rules like that that are being invoked when the individual suffers for the community as a whole. Ah, but you say, why is this fair? Why should the best people get hit in order to protect the community as a whole? It's dreadfully unfair. And the answer is this. Fairness doesn't come into it. These people love their community. These people love their community. And because they love the community, they will volunteer to take it upon themselves. Similarly to parents, as you will discover, in the not-too-distant future, I'm not recommending it. Married 6 months, don't quote me. But when you will have children, and you will see the extent of the pain and frustration and irritation and exhaustion that you're willingly pay to help your children, because they're your children. And the thought that it's not fair doesn't enter your mind. It just doesn't enter your mind. You have a child. I mean, I don't wish it on anybody, but there's a condition called colic. A colicky baby can cry for 3 weeks straight. Nobody knows why they do this. But it's, you know, it's unbelievable. They sleep fitfully an hour here, an hour there. They stop to nurse, and at the end they're crying 18, 20 hours a day. Whether it's gas or whether it's something else, nobody knows for sure. They haven't discovered any trauma in the child from this, but the parents become traumatic. There's no question about it. And you walk up and down holding the child, and you sing to the child, play music to the child, you dance with the child. The child is screaming. And you're frantic because the child is really in pain. No question about the child's pain. But never once do you think, gosh, this is unfair. He's yelling and I'm suffering. It doesn't occur to you. This is your child. So similarly, these people who feel that way about the community, they offer themselves. They volunteer themselves to take upon themselves something which can protect the community. And that then is to their great merit. The great merit that they feel so integrated and identified with the community and love the community to the extent that they're willing to take this suffering on them to protect the community, that shows their greatness, their righteousness, their holiness, and adds to their merit. So that's the way the relationship is set up. Okay? You with me?
Yeah. So even if you're a big tzaddik and, say, for example, you don't have that same connection and love for the community, then your suffering would not be to help the community?
My guess is that you're right, but I don't know. You're right in reading that from the logic of what I said. I haven't got a source for it, but that's the way I understand. Okay. Is it this?
Would it be right to say that, which is slightly separate, any suffering that you cause yourself isn't counted as suffering?
That's a nice observation. Maimonides, in the Guide, one of his main explanations of why they're suffering, why seemingly righteous people suffer, is that a great deal of our suffering is self-imposed. This is a very important category. You don't hear this talked about. In all the discussions about why people suffer, it's very rarely mentioned. But the truth is that this has three different applications. First of all, we physically abuse ourselves. A person who is overweight, smokes, gets no exercise whatsoever, and has a coronary, can't raise his fist in heaven and say, why did you do this to me? Because he did it to himself. And so forth and so on, with the things that we shouldn't eat and things we shouldn't drink, not let alone things we shouldn't inject, and the things we shouldn't smoke, and all the other things that people shouldn't do. Then we psychologically abuse ourselves. The Torah requires us to develop a certain type of personality, a certain type of character. If we would develop a Torah personality, we would be happier and healthier people. A little thing. Being able to live with the resources you have and not going after more because other people have more. About 15 years ago, I heard an interview on the radio with a yuppie in New York. They still say yuppies? And they asked her, how much money are you earning a year? She said, about $100,000. They asked her, can you make it on $100,000 a year? She said, yeah, I could just about make it. She can just about make it on $100,000 a year, living alone. Okay, it's New York. Still, what is she doing to earn $100,000 a year? She's 25 years old. She's an up-and-coming lawyer in a law firm, or she's a junior vice president in some manufacturer. Whatever it is, she's working 50 weeks a year, 60, 70 hours a week. She's pushing to earn her money. Okay, but what's with the rest of her life? Does she have any deep friendships? Does she have any interest in art, sport, travel, growing gardenias? You know, I mean, what is her life but her work? Nothing but her work. What kind of person is she becoming? But she's got to have the 100,000. She's only, and this was 100,000 American dollars 15 years ago, you know, when they were worth more. What does she need? Why does she need all that? Mostly because everybody else has it. If everybody else didn't have it, she wouldn't need it. Which means that she's sucked into a terrible competition, which is ruining her life. So, if she would develop a different character, a character that would be able to say, what do I need? You're here. I've told you this before. You go around to families here and look at how people live. You know very well, comparing with what you have in America, they're living here on very little. Now look at the people and ask, are they unhappy? Are they alcoholics? Are they committing suicide? Are they under treatment for depression? You know, is life better or worse here? I don't think it's any worse than it is in America. Maybe better, with much less money. So why is everybody chasing after all that money in America? Because everybody else has it, and you're a bum if you don't have it. Many, many people here, men, spend half a day learning Torah. In many places in America, if you do that, you'd be a bum. It wouldn't make any difference if your family had money. If you're working 20 hours a week, you're a bum. You're lazy, irresponsible, and the rest of the time you're learning Torah. No, they won't stand for it. So communities now which have invented a new idea, learning on Sundays. Instead of, you know, mowing the lawn, and taking out the sailboat, and so on and so on. From communities I'm talking about. So, if we would develop a Torah personality free from competition and free from anger, do you know what happens when you get angry? The fight or flight response. You know, all sorts of hormones go coursing through your body. And because you can't carry out the response, it's going to choke down the anger, so these terribly destructive hormones are circulating throughout your body and doing damage to your body. So if we would cultivate a Torah personality, we would be healthier and happier people. That's the second. So there's physical abuse, psychological abuse, and then there's waste of resources. I saw a figure, now this goes back a long time, but I don't guess that it's changed much, like 25 years ago, that America spends more money on cosmetics than on education. That includes men's cosmetics. This is not an anti-feminist remark. Now, that's really astonishing. Let me ask you. If the cure for cancer would cost $3 billion over the next 5 years, does the world have $3 billion over the next 5 years? I'm sorry, billions. Billions, trillion. Right, $3 trillion over the next 5 years. Does the world have that kind of money? Of course it does. But it spends it on war and entertainment and other kinds of trivia. So, when we shake our fist at the heavens and say, why do you allow cancer in your world? Maybe the answer is, I gave you the ability to cure it. I gave you all the resources to cure it. You threw them away. Why are you blaming me? Let's ask about starvation. Are there people in the world who are starving? Yes. Is there enough food in the world to feed everybody? More than enough. Loads more than enough. They pay American farmers not to plant their fields so as to support the farm prices. We could easily feed all the people in the world. We don't distribute the food. We don't distribute the economy that way. So is that God's fault that there are people who are starving? I gave it to you. You decided to hoard it and protect your economy, and those people are starving. That's not God's fault. Indeed, you could raise the radical question. How much of the sum total of human suffering is due only, solely, and completely to human irresponsibility? We don't know. Because we never tried to use our resources to cure the problems. It could be that the gigantic majority of human suffering is due to the injuries we do ourselves. And then the whole idea of asking why we're suffering is totally misguided. So I think that's an extremely important category. And of course, with that category, there's no point in raising your fist against the heavens. Yeah.
On the last example, like the starving child in Africa or somewhere, surely their suffering, yes, it is due to human distribution of food, but their suffering has to be taken account for them, because it wasn't their fault that they weren't given the food.
But this is true with all human free will, right? Why don't you talk about murder? Why go to indirect effects of the, if a person murders somebody else, or puts him in jail, or injures somebody else, or destroys his house? All free will causes injury to other people. I mean, not all, but free will can be used to cause injury to other people. That's built into the whole scheme of free will. It has nothing to do with distributing food, particularly. It has to do with free will altogether.
Is that tough luck, if you receive it?
I would say it like this. I'm encapsulating the whole Irish here into one sentence. Each person's suffering is due to a number of different causes working together. Here's a trap. They ask, why is he suffering? So you start to say, well, 10% is due to reason A, and 30% is due to reason B, and 15% is due to reason... Listen, it's getting too long. Don't give me that. Just tell me, what's the reason? That's like asking, what is the reason for health? Well, let's see, there's good diet, and then there's exercise, and then, of course, genetics has something to do. Don't be, give me a Fetcher McGillis. Just tell me, what makes people healthy? Sorry. There is no one simple answer to what makes people healthy. It's a variety of factors working together. For each person suffering, it's a variety of factors working together. Our claim, I'll do this in the evening for you, I'll do it when the JLE comes, which I probably better wait for because I have to do it to them. The answer to the problem of suffering will be this. In other words, this is the form of it. I have, let's say, 12 principles. There really isn't any more, but 12 will be enough. I have 12 principles. Now, for each person's suffering, indeed, for each particular pain that he's suffering, there's some combination of principles that explains it. Different people will get different combinations. Individual pains will get different combinations. It's not a simple system. It's like, why are people healthy? As I mentioned the other day, there are people who can eat anything. They eat anything and everything, and they never get fat. Why is he thin? His genes. Why is that guy thin? Because he struggles with a diet, and he's winning the battle, and that's why he's thin. So why are people thin? Different people, different things. Other people have combinations of these things. So that would be the structure of the answer. Now, these children, so part of it is without innocent suffering, there's no free will, and that's an investment that everybody has to pay for. Because everybody has free will. Part of it is reincarnation. You don't know what that soul did in previous occasions. Part of it is for a child building up the kind of adult that he has to be in order for him to attack the slice of perfection that's relevant to him as an adult. You have all these different factors working together. Good. These are good, important points. All right. Now, in 10, he talks about reincarnation. Give many opportunities for a soul to perfect itself. In another work, he says this. Every soul is given 4 shots, 4 incarnations. If a soul makes any progress in one of those 4 incarnations, it's guaranteed it's getting into the world to go. Even if it takes thousands of future incarnations, in order for that soul to perfect itself, guaranteed. The only soul that, now, here, it's a matter of split how you read it. The only soul that fails this scheme is a soul that for 4 straight incarnations makes no progress at all. Now what happens to that soul? So some want to read it that it's lost. Others, based on another work which explains this work and the phraseology there, want to say that its problems are taken care of by some other agency. Which would imply that all souls make it. But the normal procedure. If a soul makes any progress in 4 incarnations, then it's guaranteed to get in through the normal procedure, even if it requires thousands of incarnations later. Now, that shows you how small the percentage is that could possibly be lost. Also, to go back to something else that people said yesterday or the day before, let's figure this out. thousands of incarnations. Thousands. Thousands of incarnations. Average human life is how long?
70 years.
70 years? Okay, it used to be shorter. Let's agree on 40 years, okay? Taking got this week. 40 years. So, thousands of incarnations would be, require 40,000 years? That's 1,000. Thousands might require 80,000. I mean, we're building up, aren't we, to a rather long history. Now, you know very well that the Ramchal, like all the Kabbalists, hold that the sum total of human history is 6,000 years. So where is there room for thousands of incarnations for that poor soul which needs them? What's the answer?
Maybe nine.
What?
Little kids that die.
No.
They make it worse.
No. Slices. I'm not disappointed. Slices. 1.7, 0.3, 0.2, 0.4. Remember? Just slice the soul up. Slice it up into 1,000 pieces. You can do it, you know, one lifetime each. They can overlap. Okay.
Nobody has a soul?
No. Didn't I talk to you about this?
Yeah.
I did. Every piece of a soul has 10 under it. So every piece of a soul has the structure of a whole soul. And that's how it can work independently. But remember we talked about, I said that they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, 10. And if everyone but 2 and 9 are perfected, so 2 comes back separate and 9 comes back separate. How could 2 be a whole soul if it's only a 2? The answer is there's 2.1, 2.2, 2.3, 2.4, 2.5, 2.6, 2.7, 2.8, 2.9, and 2.10, right? So you have the whole soul structure in each piece. That's how pieces can come back. Okay. Now, yes, so 11 says, when I talk about all these causes, it doesn't mean they're always working in all cases. Each case is the result of some combination of causes. He talks about conflicts. He talked about people being in connections where not everybody can get what he deserves. We did talk about that in here, didn't we? Yeah. So, what did we talk about? So that's what he talked about in 11. And then 12 is one more very important point for this chapter. Yeah.
So we're talking about that you can have slices of the same soul. But we're saying, we said that each soul has the specific job that it has to do. So now, I thought we said the job can be that you'll start out, let's say, poor, and then get rich, and then get poor. So does that mean when you have a slice of it, that each slice also is going to be poor, rich, poor? Or does the slice up different by, or how would it work in that manner?
That's a good question. I guess it would depend upon how that poor, rich, poor pattern affects the slice. For example, if the problem is, how can I deal with the fact that I have lots of money? How can I deal with the fact that I have little money? How can I deal with the fact that I have lots of money? Back and forth. So then, if that slice isn't perfected, that particular aspect of the challenge isn't perfected, then the next time it'll have to be. Same poor, rich, poor. But let's suppose part of the challenge is dealing with instability. Okay, it happens in this case, the instability is monetary. But if the money problem is taken care of, but the person is still driven around the bend by instability, so then you could put that slice of the soul into a situation with a different kind of instability. So I imagine it would be the particular aspect of the problem that didn't get perfected that will be required to. Okay, now in paragraph 12, he says something interesting, which someone challenged me once a long time ago. He said, I'm giving you a reason why things happen. Lots and lots of different reasons. I told you that for any particular event, it could be combinations of reasons. It's a pretty flexible system, because there are lots of different reasons. Now he says, I got one more gigantic element of flexibility to introduce. An event that happens doesn't need to be an expression of one of the rules or a combination of rules. It could be a means to an event, which is an expression of the rules. It doesn't have to directly realize the rules. It can only be a means to something else that realizes the rules. The famous incident of the Talmud, which I think he mentions here. The guy's plowing with his cow, and the cow slips and breaks its leg, and as he's tending to the cow, he notices something protruding from the soil, and he digs it up and finds its buried treasure. Now, the buried treasure was necessary because, right, to invest in his mitzvos, because of the things he'd done in the past. That follows from the rules. But, cow breaking the leg? The cow's breaking the leg was just the way in which he found the buried treasure. That's all. So the breaking of the leg doesn't follow from any of the rules. It's not a punishment for something he did in the past, and it's not to force him to become more sensitive to the pain of animals, and all the things you could think of. No, it's just a means to his finding the treasure. So when you look at something that happens, you don't always have to trace what happens back to some combination of the rules. It could be just a means to something that happens for the sake of the rules. Now, many years ago, someone in Australia wrote me a letter that I visited there about 14 years ago. Someone, I guess, who heard me speak there, wrote me a letter and said, why does it have to be a category of means to ends? We're talking about God now. God is running the world. He has all these rules for things to happen. All these purposes for things to happen. Why can't he guarantee, why can't he arrange it that each thing that happens fulfills the purpose? Or some combination of purposes. Why does he need a means to end scattered? That was a very good question. It's a very good question. A matter of divine economy. You know? It took me a long time. I think I lost his email address in the interim, a couple of years. I was thinking about it. I don't know if I ever got to write him back. I think I can reduce half the question. I don't know if it's a total answer, but I can reduce half the question. Philosophically, the question is, why would God introduce a category of means to ends? Why couldn't he arrange that everything that happens, it be directly an expression of the ends? The answer is, to that question, is that the whole world is built on means to ends. The whole creation is built on means to ends. Means to ends is a necessary element in the creation as a whole. You can't avoid that category. Even God can't avoid that category. So, the idea of eliminating the whole category is impossible. Then all you could have left over was, well, okay, once the category's in, must you use it all the time? But that, I don't think it's such a terribly significant question. Why can't God avoid the category? Because, in order for us, back to part 1, chapter 2, in order for us to be independent, to exercise free will, to be self-determined, to be godlike. In order for that to happen, God has to hide his presence. Otherwise he overwhelms us. Otherwise we can't have any independence. And God hiding his presence is evil. God creates evil. He makes evil. He makes it because it is a necessary means to the good that he wants to accomplish. So in the very creation itself, there is built in a means to end relationship. It's inescapable. That being the case, the category is there willy-nilly. Category's there no matter what you can do. So then all you could say is, okay, I understand that he has to work with the category, but how come in these particular cases he didn't go straight to the ends, he used the means to ends? I don't know. At that point, the question is a question of detail. It's a question of quantity, not quality. And I don't know, I don't know, have a good example, a good answer for that. Why why he wouldn't work it out more often the other way. In my mind, if you have to get the guy a treasure, I don't see why a cow has to break its leg. You know, there are other ways you can get the guy a treasure. So it seems to me. But once you realize that the category is there, then the question is much less pressing. It's still a question, but it's not nearly as pressing as it was before. Yeah.
The category could still be there, but it's not like in just these particular cases. It's the entire... It's in everyday life. Yes, the category can be there in the world at large, but doesn't... But these particular cases means everyday life, and that's a pretty huge particular case.
Yeah, okay. As I say, maybe... I don't know, maybe this is just a matter of philosophical taste. Once the category is there, once the creation as a whole has to rest on this pillar, whether you use the pillar more or less, it's still a question, but it's not...
The pillar could be there, but it doesn't have to apply at all.
Ever? It has to apply.
It has Otherwise, to apply sometimes, yes, right. in the underlying foundation of the world, but not in its... I guess actuality, I don't know.
Well, I guess, let me just then just describe where the next step would have to be. The next step would have to be to describe what's the loss. What is the loss in having an event which itself doesn't fulfill any of the purposes, it's just a means to an end? What's the loss? Why is that necessarily a negative that we want to take off? If we
waste
could just...
Of action.
Sorry?
Waste of energy.
Well, if you have a finite amount of energy, then you might be worried about wasting it. But I don't know if God has a finite amount of energy.
Should we assume that a perfect system would not waste anything?
It depends about what the negative is in the waste. It depends about what the cost is in the waste. It depends upon, you know... Anyway, I think that's the next step. In the investigation, the next step is to define exactly what the cost is, so you know what could possibly justify the cost. I haven't done that in detail, so I'm not going to take it any further. He does say that at the end of the next chapter, that the example of this is what happens to the non-Jews in the world. Next chapter is Israel the Nations. And what he says at the very end of the chapter is that an example of the means to end relationship is that what happens to the non-Jews of the world basically is for the sake of its impact on the Jewish people. Here is a kind of environment, not only, but what happens to them is basically an environment in which the Jewish people can succeed in perfecting the creation as a whole. So there is a very striking and large-scale application of the means-to-ends relationship. I don't know, I'll just, one more minute, I'll share with you perhaps a speculation. Would a human being be capable of all his actions being ends? Is that a possible option for a human life? I don't think so. Now, every category by which human beings live has to be created into the world. Every category has to be created into the world. I think I mentioned this to you at one point. In the first section, Ramchal says, what would have happened if Adam had succeeded and passed the test in the Garden of Eden? And he gives a description. There would have been lots of people that stood up in different groups without any strain of free will because that test would have been passed. There's some description of what would have happened. Now, why would God set up a plan of what would have happened if, when he knows it isn't going to happen? Does God need contingency plans? Contingency plans are only for those who are ignorant, who don't know what's going to happen. If you know what's going to happen, you don't set up a contingency plan. You just plan for the thing you know is going to happen. So why does God need a contingency plan? My answer is, because we need contingency plans, because we're not omniscient, and he has to introduce the category into the creation. Otherwise, it won't be there for us to use. That's why he makes a contingency plan. Everything we use has to be created by God. So he has to create it. So here also could be that in order for us to use means to ends activities in our world, he too has to put that category into our world. Otherwise, it won't be there for us to use it. So far, yeah.
creating that category doesn't necessarily mean that he has to use it.
I don't know what it means to create it without using it. God made those contingency plans. He made them.
Yes, in the world.
No. But everything is created by divine activity. I mean, this is a, it's an
abstract. We will obviously be able to see the concepts in the world because that's the way we live. That we use.
Yes, but
that
where?
That God actually has to use.
I don't know. It depends on what it means by creating it. What does it mean to create a principle of this kind? What does it mean for the principle to exist? Imagine that the principle has to be there before I use it, so that I can use it. So then, what being does it have before I use it?
Nothing, the ability that you're able to use it.
Yeah, but that ability has to rest on something. You know, the sugar is able to dissolve in water because it has a certain molecular structure. Right? If it didn't have a molecular structure, it wouldn't have it. The ability to do something is based on a present reality. How that reality functions. Here, it's a nothing. Until I use it, it's a nothing in your scheme. That's metaphysically not, If he does it, then he's created it by doing it, putting it into the world through action. Right? Then it becomes part of the fabric of the world. If not...
Does that mean anything that he does comes into the fabric of the world?
Well, when he speaks the word, something comes into existence, right? The whole physical world came into existence because he made it be through his speech. Now, here we're talking about a principle. So it's not a physical thing. What kind of being does a principle have that he can provide it for the world? Right? A star is a collection of gas, okay. But a principle is an abstract thing. How did that principle have reality in the world? So if he acts on the principle, then you say it became part of the fabric of history, the divine history of the world. If not, it's not easy to say what reality it is.
And a human can't just have a human just go ahead and do it without him first.
So I'm saying the principle has to be available for the human being to use. Otherwise, the new thing is coming into existence through the human being's action.
No, it could have been in existence before. Then it just wasn't an actual problem.
It doesn't have any existence. An abstract principle had it going to. Sure it does.